Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the next edition of the Patika Wealth Management Group call series. My name is James Patika, and I'm joined by John Patika Jr., who is the portfolio manager on our team, the Patika Wealth Management Group here in Clearwater, Florida. And on today's call, we're going to be diving into the world of two key sectors, both the consumer staples and consumer discretionary. Now, these sectors not only play a pivotal role in shaping our economy, but also represent the goods and services that we interact with in our everyday lives. And our guest, Sunny Mara, is a consumer discretionary and consumer staples equity strategist here at UBS. And before joining UBS in 2022, Sunny worked at several different hedge funds, including DE Shaw, Karsh Capital, and Anandar Capital. He has over 15 years of direct investment experience and has held sector head, analyst, and portfolio management positions throughout his career. And we're happy you can join us today, Sunny. And with that, I'll welcome you to the call.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, welcome, Sunny. So let's just start off on just talking about the health of the consumer. You know, obviously, since the pandemic, people's buying habits change. I feel like I'm tripping over Amazon boxes every time I come home from work. Could you talk a little bit about where the consumer is today?
Sure, that's a good way to introduce what we're seeing. So I'd say overall, stepping back, the consumer is pretty healthy. Like, there's a lot of talk out there, doom and gloom, consumer sentiment seems to be weak. But when you look at the actual data and when you see consumers out there, they're spending. And so the data supports a pretty healthy consumer. Now, there's some pockets of weakness, I would say, just among the very low end, but the mid to upper income consumer is doing quite well. And a few points I'll make. The bottom 20%, the bottom kind of quintile of the income spectrum, they only represent less than 10% of total spending, whereas the top quintile, the top 20%, represent about 40% of total spending. So even though we're seeing some weakness on the bottom 20%, in the context of overall consumer spending and the health of the economy and the health of the goods and services sector, consumer related, things are holding up just fine. Now, you said consumer habits coming out of COVID. Yeah, I mean, COVID was a big shock to the system. Basically, what you had is the good side, the demand went through the roof, essentially. Right? We're all working from home, anything housing related, et cetera, you know, electronics, housing, sporting goods, whatever you call it, all that demand went through the roof. And that was kind of the first year or two when we were locked down in COVID. And the services side really lagged. And as you saw the lockdowns lift, you basically had the services side rebound massively and the good side just stabilized, like not grow from where it was. And so you had that the past, I'd say, a couple of years. You had revenge travel in there as well. And you just had people wanting to get out and about, and you had some more, you know, the work from home wasn't 5 days a week anymore. You know, you started going back in the office. So people were more out and about, going to restaurants, et cetera. And she saw the services side rebound quite a bit. She basically had two totally opposite things going on. Now we're finally in some state of, I'd say, more normal. The services side continues to grow because that's historically actually grown faster than goods. And the good side is flat, but with rate cuts, there's a good chance that going into next year, the good side starts to rebound as well. So you're getting into a more, frankly, normalized state, what you saw pre-COVID, where services does a little better than goods, but both are, you know, should be okay, essentially.
I remember the toilet paper. Remember the toilet paper craze? Everybody was stocking up on toilet paper.
Boy, I was just wearing hand sanitizer. Those are the things.
Yeah, not kidding. Well, speaking of like themes that we're seeing, you know, there's obviously a health and wellness theme we're seeing in your sector, as well as like organic products. I mean, I was just going through my refrigerator the other day. I didn't realize my wife was buying organic ketchup. I didn't even know there was such a thing as organic Heinz ketchup. But anyway, could you talk a little bit about some of the trends in health and wellness that you're seeing?
Sure. That's a good place to start. We're definitely seeing that. I have a similar thing. If I buy something non-organic, my wife's kind of like, why didn't you buy the organic side? You know what to buy, et cetera, et cetera. So you've definitely seen that on the food side. And there's been definitely this trend towards more fresh and away from canned food, shelf-stable food, towards more just fresh food in general. And within fresh, even a trend towards kind of the organic versus non-organic. Or I think in food, it's very obvious when you go into whatever grocery you go into that you're seeing that trend. And that shows up in the data in terms of what's growing faster within food. And you're seeing that hurt some packaged food companies because they're not at the forefront of healthy eating, let's say, some of the packaged food companies, the traditional ones that we grew up with when we were kids, let's say. So you're starting to see that within food. And then outside of food, you've had this athleisure trend going on for several years now. It's been kind of started pre-COVID And then COVID really accelerated it. Just a more casual look, a more sporty look, buy more sneakers, et cetera. That really spiked during right when COVID hit, the year or two kind of right when COVID hit. And then it slowed down quite a bit over the past, I'd say, year, maybe up to 2 years. It's still growing, but it's growing at a slower rate than it was during the COVID era. So I would say that's one area to kind of watch out for, because a lot of companies got really big, or they thought, you know, we have all these sales, it's easy. And now that trend, the growth rate of that trend is starting to slip, and you have a lot of upstarts entering that space. And so it's just a much more competitive dynamic in that athleisure space, let's say. But the overall trend is still holding, let's say. It's still growing. So I'd call it those two areas.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about supply chains. Obviously, we're not seeing the 150 ships outside of the LA port like we did during the pandemic. And, you know, there's a lot of political rhetoric, too, about reshoring a lot of our supply chains. But could you talk a little bit about global supply chain like challenges that we're having right now? I mean, what are companies trying to do? Are they trying to stay local, trying to diversify a little bit? What are you seeing?
I'd say the primary thing, frankly, and especially when you talk to them separately or individually, they will tell you they're absolutely trying to diversify away from China. That is the one big thing. Some have really intricate ways they're going about it. They're like pushing their suppliers in some way. I've heard one big retailer I've spoken to say, okay, we want to go a third towards Mexico, a third towards Southeast Asia, a third towards the US. And that's just one big retailer. But like, those are the big areas, I would say. I'd say the reshoring to the US is probably the laggard of the three, but the shift to Mexico is definitely real. And the shift to other parts of Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Vietnam, et cetera, that's probably the most ahead. And that started a few years ago. And we're seeing a big push. And then to break it down even further, I'd say the soft goods side, if you think sneakers, apparel, et cetera, that's moving pretty quickly out of China. And a lot of it's already moved out of China. Now, there's still a bunch in China. The hard goods side is lagging, and that's starting to move out of China. The toughest thing to move out of China is electronics. And that's what's really not moved. That whole supply chain is still in China for the most part. But the rest of it, when you look at how companies are acting, they've really done a good job incrementally kind of getting whatever growth is happening, that's definitely away from China. But then even what they have in China already, some of it's already moving away. And then I'd say in general, other supply chain, I mean, COVID basically got companies to be more efficient. It forced their hand, right? So all their supply chain groups internally, all just how they deal with suppliers, the options they have or backup plans they have are at least all in place now. So when you see, you know, there's talk of like an East Coast port strike now, at least the companies are better positioned because they can move the goods around to the West Coast ports. They can bring them in quicker before the holiday season. They can do a bunch of these things that they're just more nimble now. And I think the whole supply chain, it's still obviously too exposed to China and a lot would argue kind of too much outside the US, et cetera. But they've started to make those changes. And I think the companies are just a lot more nimble than they were when COVID hit a few years ago. And so they're a lot more able to adapt.
Is there a particular like country that's actually benefiting about with companies that are trying to move out of China?
I'd say Mexico for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Because we have the free trade agreement. It's our neighbor. It's relatively cheap. It's easy. And then you think about once you set something up, like you also save on your freight costs and your ocean costs, right? You're not shipping across oceans. So once you have it set up, you can be even more nimble because it's so close, right? So that lag time is closer. So there's a lot of benefits once you do it. So I think companies that are kind of thinking long-term, they're really making that push, but Mexico definitely stands out.
Yeah, and I know the Indian stock market is doing really well too. It makes sense with Mexico because you're so close and you don't have to go over to transport your stuff. But how about India? Are they benefiting?
They are incrementally. I would say Bangladesh is more apparel they're benefiting. India is kind of apparel and a little bit of electronics and some other things. So India is benefiting. It's just, you know, it's a decent sized country already. So it's incremental, but it's definitely benefiting. Mm-hmm. I'd say India, I'd say Vietnam has benefited. Yeah, Bangladesh on the apparel side. So I mean, a lot of those countries across Asia. But long-term, when you think about it, that's kind of so far. Long-term, over the next 10 years, you're right. India should benefit a lot more because it has the people capability. Once they get infrastructure a little better there, you should start to see more and more plants and where you can make a little more complex stuff show up there.
Let's change gears a little bit and talk about inflation. And, you know, there's a lot of I know inflation, the inflation report came out this morning and, you know, inflation came back down more towards that targeted 2%. But since the pandemic, I mean, inflation is still up. There's companies have to deal with rising costs of like raw materials. Labor is expensive. How are companies managing their margins in this environment? I mean, could you talk a little bit about what they even have for pricing power?
Sure. I would say if you take the raw materials and you take labor, the raw material side is definitely leveling off. So you've kind of had a big uptick, but now it's leveling off. And, you know, even recently, while it's starting to come down, et cetera. So you're not seeing that big of a hit on the raw material side. On labor, you're right. Labor still, you know, most companies we speak to, labor inflation is still running at about 4% at least, which is not crazy high like it was during the inflation spike, but still higher than it used to be pre-COVID. But most companies have been able to deal with that, get a little more productivity, a little more efficient, so they can deal with the current inflation state. I'd say where we're really starting to see it is was what you brought up, the pricing power. And things like consumer staples, pricing power is starting to wane. It's just the cumulative in pricing, like all that inflation, all that pricing that a lot of these companies have taken has been 30% in a lot of places. And that's just too high. I mean, that's a lot in like 3 to 4 years. And so consumers are starting to push back. You're seeing it on the food side. You're seeing a shift towards more kind of the store brands a little bit. You're seeing it on the fast food QSR side, definitely kind of a pushback saying my meal deal, you know, fried soda and burger used to be $8 and now it's like $12 or whatever, or $13, or it depends on what area you're at. People are like really pushing back and those companies are starting to feel it. And you, in the fast food space, you're starting to see them react. They're coming out with the previous price points on the meal deals, et cetera, because the customers have left them. So you're starting to see it on those two sides for sure, on the consumer staples across the board. And then within the restaurant space on the low to mid end, I'd say the fast food side, the area where pricing power is holding up still is, you know, the very good brands. Like, you know, the whole thing is like we take pricing up consistently kind of year over year. There's a few brands like that that still continue to do that. And on the leisure side, I would say the upper end of leisure is still holding pricing really well. If you take Vegas, for example, the top properties in Vegas can continue to price. The mid to low end properties are having a tough time pricing. And that's kind of indicative of leisure across the board. The very high-end properties, I mean, some prices are 50 to 100% above COVID, and they're still getting priced on top of that. It's incredible. But the low-end properties are struggling more. I'd say that's where the pricing power lies.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing that with hotels now. I was reading something in the journal about these hotel stays are $1,000 a night, and that's all of a sudden becoming normal. It's like, how high could it go, you know?
Yeah, it seems crazy when you... Like if you had said 5 years ago, this would be kind of the new normal, you'd be like, wow, you wouldn't have expected that.
Yeah. But speaking of technology, you're seeing a lot of companies like with McDonald's, I mean, you're seeing kiosks and they're just trying to get less humans and more computers and automation involved. Could you talk about how technology is kind of shaping the consumer staples sector to make it more profitable and efficient?
You brought up a good example. That's a big push. You see it with the no cashiers at registers, you see at the kiosks at the restaurants, the fast food restaurants, taking out that labor that has been inflating essentially for these staples companies and retailers and restaurants. That's one big push. Where you're also seeing it is within the supply chain. You don't really see it from our end, but within the warehousing and supply chain aspect, that's more early stages, but they're starting to put a lot of money into that because the warehouse inflation has gone up a lot too with workers there, et cetera. So you're starting to see more of the technology being used on managing the logistics and the warehousing side. And on the consumer facing side, it's what you talked about. It's on AI specifically, you're starting to see companies use it. They have like internal AIs that's only for their own, you know, employees. And the large retailers are starting to use it on consumer facing things too, like better recommendations when you're searching for something, linking different products that previously wouldn't have been linked before when you search, because AI is smarter at doing that. Basically, if you see a review on a large retailer, like you have to, before you have to read through all the 4-star reviews, 5-star reviews, going through all the reviews, they'll summarize in one paragraph. AI will summarize it in one paragraph. So you don't have to look through all the reviews at once. So there is a lot of things happening. I would say none of it is like fully implemented. Some of it's earlier stages. Some of it's kind of mid stages. I would say none of it's really kind of at that late stage yet.
I definitely think there's some resistance with the older folks to get into the digital age. I know when we go up to Pennsylvania, we got a cabin up in Pittsburgh, and there was one McDonald's we always stop at before we get up there. And as we're driving out, and there's a kiosk, and my brother and I will stop at the kiosk and we'll go ahead digitally order. But John Sr. refuses, wants to talk to a human. And he'll go up there, and James and I will be done. We'll be eating our food, done with the food. And he's still looking for a human to come over and serve him. So he needs to get with it.
Yeah, it's funny. That's definitely something we've seen. And I think that, you know, it slows it a bit. If you go to Europe, though, like, those kiosks are everywhere in McDonald's. Like, it is basically, like, much more penetrated than it is in the U.S. or something like that.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what you think this industry is going to look like 5-10 years down the road? And where should a long-term investor pretty much focus their attention?
So I'd say a couple of things. That's a really good question, kind of thinking out. I would say the big retailers, as we kind of spoke about, and the very big consumer staples companies do have some advantages because of this technology, because not all the companies can afford to invest so much in AI, afford to invest so much in automating warehouses, afford to invest so much in logistics and delivery and capability. You know, the consumer expects something for a retailer. Like, if you order it online, they all have good websites at this point, but they want that delivery within a couple of days. You know, nobody's waiting a week or two anymore. They want the option to pick it up in store. And that means linking up your inventory. Before, you used to buy something on the website, it would come straight from the warehouse. Now all these retailers have to be smart enough on the back end that the inventory is able to be in the store for you to pick up as well. Like, you have to have both options. And so that's really the back end that we don't see at the consumer side, but some retailers do that well, and some of the smaller ones haven't caught up yet. And so I think a lot of the big on the retail side, especially the big retailers, should continue to hold their advantages on that, because it just takes a lot. And they have a real estate footprint, a lot of them too, that's hard to replicate. They just built up those stores over a long period of time. So I would say on the retail side, the big retailers should continue to do well and take share and hold share or take share, essentially. On the consumer staples, especially on the food, I think that's more at risk. And we've seen it with kind of what you were talking about, health and wellness. People aren't attracted as much or as loyal to the brands that they were, you know, when we grew up, let's say. And so I think there is a real risk there on some of the brands if they don't keep up with innovation, keep coming up with new formulations, new flavors, new kind of items, that you risk falling behind. And so, you know, it's easy now with social media to kind of start up a new brand as long as you have distribution. So the retailers still have the distribution, they should be fine. But you can have smaller food brands attacking larger food brands easier, frankly, in the next 5-10 years. And I think you're already starting to see that happen, where some new drink brand, some new food brand, and it goes viral and people are like, oh, what's this new thing? And it gets really popular. And so I think those two things you have to watch out for, kind of, I think on the retailers are well positioned. I think the large staples companies, you know, they have the distribution internationally, they're well positioned. But the mid end on the food and consumer staples, and some of those companies that I think they could be at risk, kind of those mid end companies where you're not kind of the market share leader, and then private labels kind of creeping up on you, and then you have upstarts that can start a brand. That's going to be very tough when you're kind of the middle player. And then internationally, as I look out, look, the past decade or two, everybody is focused on China. That's where the growth was. And I think that's going to change for the next decade, basically. You look out the next 5-10 years, these companies, you want to be focused on India and Latin America. Those are your two growth areas. You know, demographics are much better than China. Your birth rates, I know they have some stimulus going on now that they're putting in, but that's not going to solve the structural problem in China. It's not going to solve your birth rate problem. So on the 5-10 year basis, you know, you'd rather have in the smarter companies putting more resources towards India and Latin America versus China, or versus doubling down, let's say, on China. So I think that's something you also have to pay attention to and what you're investing in.
Yeah, I read something about China on their population growth is going to like nosedive in like the next decade or something like that, because they had that one child policy, then they walked it back to the two child policy, and it's staggering what's going to happen to their population.
Exactly. Yeah, those are your customers a few decades out, right? Like, and I don't think you can reverse it.
No, absolutely not. So we're getting close to the end of our call here, and wanted to see if you had any final thoughts before we wrap up.
No, look, these are great questions, and I appreciate you having me on. The only final thought I'd have is that I leave you with that no matter what you hear about the consumer, I feel like people over extrapolate one data point I just want to leave with the message that the overall consumer is healthy, resilient, and essentially fine. I don't want anybody coming out of this thinking that because the low end is a little weaker or because sentiment down or anything like that, that there's some risk to the overall U.S. consumer. I think the U.S. consumer is actually in a very healthy spot right here.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much, Sonny. And again, we really appreciate you joining us. And if anyone listening has any questions on what we discussed or would like to receive UBS's recent research reports on the consumer discretionary and staples sectors, please reach out and let us know. We're happy to share those with you. And feel free to share this podcast with any friends or family you think this may be valuable to. And with that, take care, everyone. And thank you again, Sonny, for joining us today.
Thank you.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.